Welcome to Farming Aotearoa with agricultural journalist Peter Burke. Kia ora and welcome once again to Farming Aotearoa, a program in which agricultural journalist Peter Burke brings us up to date with what's happening in our rural areas. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Catherine. It's nice to be here again in this lovely studio on a lovely, fine, wet, misty day in Kapiti, which has been for a long time.
I think you bring the weather with you. I remember it being like this last time, I think.
I know. And
we're going to blame you.
The only time there's been any good weather is when I went to Australia, actually.
Oh, yeah?
30 degrees there. I mean, that's what I love.
But, yeah. You
know, anything less than 30 is a bit cold for me. Anyway, I won't go on about the weather because I'm going to talk about that later probably anyway.
Ah, okay. So what is up, Pete?
So the first up, we're going to look at the issue of forestry. And it's interesting because there's a lot of talk around about carbon credits and all that sort of thing. But we saw recently that a freezing works in the South Island, Smithfield, closed down. And that was a Timaru. Now, to be fair to that, that particular works, I suspect, was an old one. It was, you know, nearly 150 years old. It was probably coming to the end of its life. But one of the reasons it closed down was that stock numbers have dropped. And that's something that has happened because of a number of things. We'll call it land use change for a start, then we'll get down to the real honest truth about it. A lot of that land that has traditionally had sheep on, has gone two ways. In some cases, it's gone to wine. And if you look at the Wairarapa, that was sheep country when I was, you know, started off in this business. It's now wonderful wine country. All these parts of it are.
It'd be hard to complain about that, wouldn't it?
No, you can't. I'm not complaining about that. Mm. But what I am complaining about, or what I think people are complaining about, is the fact that some very good land, which would still be quite good for livestock, is being put in pine trees, Christmas trees, if you want to be crude.
Yeah, I'm not so happy about that.
No, and that's the problem, and that's starting to see the number of sheep numbers drop a lot. We've seen this progressively happening over years, and to some extent it's been masked by the efficiency of the sheep industry. What's happened is we've the lambing percentage, in other words, the number of lambs produced per ewe, has increased over the years. And that has meant that we've produced almost the same number of lambs, or just a few percent less, for about half the number of ewes. However, the ewe flock is now declining. And that means that that we are now losing a considerable amount of land to forestry, and that is having an effect on the number of sheep. And just some figures to quote that, you know, since the end of 2022, more than 51,000 hectares of farmland has been sold to forestry industries. That's a lot. And I go up and down the island quite a lot. I'm not just sort of sitting in a little land of Koku where I live, but I've actually been up and down the island a lot. And I'm seeing land go into forestry, which I think should be returned to grass. On the other hand, I see also land which probably should never have been put in forest for anything in the first place. It should be just put into native trees because some of those, that forestry, once it's cut, will just cause another problem. It's a problem in waiting 30 years hence, as we've seen in, you know, in other parts up in Te Rāwhiti.
Yeah.
So Beef and Lamb's chairperson, Kate Ackland, says, you know, for every 10,000 hectares planted close to 1 million stock units are lost. So that's a loss. So every time you put a tree, and just think of, you might be replacing a sheep. Is that log going to produce as much as a sheep? Probably not. So there's a, while they're saying they're not anti-forestry, and there was a big deal many years ago about forest farming, which was a good thing where you combined forestry and farming. There has got to be some sensibility around this thing, which there isn't at the moment. And people are planting forestry, do I say, in some cases willy-nilly, at the expense of the long-term gain for New Zealand, because we know that communities, where there are sheep farms, those communities bring lots of people in different ways. They create services which are required all the time. There's transport companies. There's a whole infrastructure built around livestock farming, which isn't built around tree planting, quite different. So a community will survive. We see in other parts of the world the same thing. Small farms, build infrastructure, build villages, build towns, whatever they are, and that's where it is. So it's a community thing. So communities are being lost now. You go through the island, and I you know, over the years I've seen a lovely couple of nice places where I used to buy my meat pies on the way up to Hamilton, closed. Dairies closed, And rural New Zealand has been gutted by some of the sections. And, you know, I've got a view about it. I've got to be careful because there's probably some people who think that growing Christmas trees is the best thing since bread was sliced into smaller portions than it normally should be. But anyway.
I just chopped down a weedy tree that, you know, that's grown in a place where it shouldn't, where the horses would trip over it. So we just chopped down a weed.
Yeah, and I think there's a place for trees. And one of the things that I think about farms is there should be trees on farms.
Oh,
because
the animals love them.
Stock animals love them. I mean, I've got in my own place, I planted some trees when I first arrived there 20-odd years ago. And now when I look out when it starts to rain, where do the sheep go? Under the trees. When it starts to get hot, where do the sheep go? Under the trees.
I think we should have more trees
I think we
for
should
that.
Too. And yeah. I think that's a problem for stock, that it's an animal welfare issue to me, that trees should be around there. Where you put them, it's on the boundary maybe, so you don't, you know, have an impact on irrigators, but still shade is important. And yeah. I know that I'm going to go to a field day next week, I think, looking at this issue of shade and the impact it has on, because it does reduce stress on animals.
Yeah,
we know that.
Absolutely.
Being out in the sun, they don't sort of turn on their backs and lie down and suntan their bellies, do they? Really?
No, they don't.
Seen a sheep doing sunbathing yet.
Yeah.
Or a cow, more or less.
And they've got no choice.
They haven't.
You know, people say, oh, they're fine. Well, what choice have they got?
And I think the interesting thing is when you look at animal behaviour, and I've seen it in my own place, that if you give a sheep a choice,
yes,
what do they do?
They go onto it.
They go for shade.
Yep.
They go for shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's natural.
People say animals are dumb, but I think there's more dumb animals, and there's one standing for the presidency of the United States at the moment, I think, actually. Anyway.
Well, I think by the time this goes to air, we'll know the answer to that.
I know.
So
let's move off that. Anyway.
Talk to us then about the new trade agreement.
Yeah, just out recently is a new deal with which what's called the Gulf Cooperation Council. This is a consortium, if you like, of a number of countries, Bahrain, Kuwait, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. And this is a deal which has just been put together. It's been announced by the current Trade Minister, Todd McClay, but I think there's been a number of other trade ministers in the past who've had a hand in putting this together, and, of course, the officials who do the nitty-gritty detail work. But it's a very big deal for the dairy industry in particular because the dairy exports to that group is worth close to $2 billion. It's $1.9 billion, which is big. And it's significant for that. And there's also the suggestion that this trade deal, also we've got meat in that mix as well. There's a couple of million, $260 million worth of meat going there. There's some horticulture going there. And there's some other travel and services. So it's a big group. And we've seen recently there was another deal with the United Arab Emirates that was also put together recently. So now New Zealand is in quite a good position with the Middle East countries for tariff-free access to those markets. And they're growing. They're high-value markets. That's a great thing for us. We don't deal in feeding the world. We deal in feeding the rich of the world with most of our products. And here's an example of it. So we're hearing some very good comments from the chief executive or executive director of the Dairy Companies Association saying, it's a great deal, keep up the good work, government, we like what you're doing. We need more of these free trade agreements or trade agreements, whatever you like to call them, and, you know, keep on the work. And the other thing also is there's a chap called Stephen Jacoby who represents the New Zealand International Business Forum, again saying the same thing. This deal is a great deal, it's great for New Zealand, it's great. It sets the precedent for us. We're into these places now, and that's good. It's about diversification and getting. And one of the things that New Zealand has to work on all the time is to get tariff-free access. We've got a debate going at the moment with Canada over that, where they've tried to stop our dairy products going in there and not reducing the tariffs as agreed upon. That's now going to a disputes tribunal. I don't know what the result of that is, but I get a bit sick of hearing people talking about how we're all for free trade. Well, the answer to that is bullshit in many cases, because they simply don't seem to do what they say they're going to do. They change their mind, they protect their own farmers, and that's fine, we all do. But if you're going to be honest about it, try to be honest.
Well, you've got to be upfront about it at the beginning.
You do, and they haven't been. And Canada is an example of actually basically lying through their teeth about the whole thing, because they signed up to a deal, they haven't honoured it, and that's a quite a big bone of contention between New Zealand and Canada,
yeah.
And it's quite serious, and it affects our dairy industry in particular. Canada wanting to protect its own dairy farmers, presumably so that their politicians can get elected. They don't care about whether I mean, we all know about politicians. They're there to be re-elected. They're not there to do anything for the community. That's a byproduct of them getting into power. That's just Prime Minister, by the way, too. That's not me. So I can quote a very authoritative documentary on that one. I've always said that.
Oh, we all love it, don't we?
Well, I always remember telling people, don't bother doing a degree in political science. Go down to the warehouse and buy 10 episodes of Yes Minister and you'll have your degree in about 3 days' time if you watch it all the time. That's as much you'll learn. Anyway, so we're talking about degrees, aren't we? Yeah.
We are. So new Massey graduates.
Yeah, interesting.
And some new degree courses.
It's Massey, I think, really moving with the times. Mm. What they're saying is that we are, and agriculture changes, obviously, you need different skills are required by consultants of the future. And this is building on that and saying, okay, we need to must make some changes, some tweaks around our degree so that we get graduates who are, dare I say, industry ready is what we're probably talking about. So what they're doing is combining two degrees. The Bachelor of Earth and Environmental Science replaces two separate degrees, which has been one around earth science and the other around environmental science, putting them into one package and making it one degree, which in the view of the deputy head of that School of Agriculture and Environment, Professor Danny Donahue, who's a great guy, says this is the way to go, this is what the industry is telling us we need to do. It's more relevant. We're going to bring people through that course with a greater degree of skills than perhaps the two separate ones. Bring it together, gives people more options. And I think degrees are about teaching people to think. That's really what it's about. We won't go down too much on that track. But anyway, but I think that's one of the big things. The other degree that they're looking at is around incorporating horticultural management into the existing business degree of Bachelor of Agribusiness. So what they're saying is that in horticulture is a business, right? And it's more than just picking fruit. And this is about people who want to maybe make a career in agriculture and horticulture, but having the business skills to go with it. Like it might be running a factory, it might be running a pack house, it might be marketing, but so they can do their business degree, but they can major in horticulture as along with it. So that they come out of that course with a specific career path in mind that's to go into the business of horticulture in its widest forms. It might be, who knows, it might be working for MPI, it might be working for Foreign Affairs, it could be anyone. It could be working at a pack house, but it's getting people lined up to do the management jobs at horticulture. And that is becoming a bigger business because we're seeing right around the country the horticulture enterprises are getting bigger. You know, the days of the small grower are dying. There are still some there, but we've noticed over time that is changing. So therefore, this is to sort of pick on the idea that these people will need to be better qualified and be responsive to what the industry wants. If you're going to go to a big enterprise, you'll need to be. They'll demand of you. Therefore, if you've got the skills, the knowledge, and nowhere to go for the knowledge, which is as important as anything else. It's not so much. You can't teach everyone the answers, but what you can teach people, and this is what they're talking about, is to know where to go for the answers. And that's as important as knowing them.
Horticulture has changed so much anyway over the years. This makes sense.
It has. I mean, we used to call it market gardening, you know, but now it's commercial growing.
Yeah.
If you look at what we did, you know, if you look at the machinery that's in some of these operations, it's huge. It's big.
Robotics.
We've got robotics.
All the automation.
Automation's big. And I think that's one of the comments that they're saying now. It's a problem. It has been for a long time with getting students to do degrees in agriculture or in particularly horticulture. That on the news most of the time, most of the stories that we see are about a problem of getting enough people to pick the fruit in the orchard. And therefore, the parents and the teachers and the students think, horticulture means I'm just going to go a degree and pick fruit.
Mm.
Well, there's nothing further than the truth than that. However, that's a perception, and it's hard to change because I've done some work myself personally around that, taking at one stage, you know, for about a number of years, a busload of careers advisors from Wellington up to Massey and other places to show them the technology that's in the agricultural sector, and I think they were quite blown away by it. I keep saying to them, there's more technology in this dairy shed than there is in your office, your whole school. And they looked at me and said, come on, how do you think a pack house runs? How do you think they sort asparagus? How do they sort kiwi fruit? It's not done by people looking and saying, oh, that's a big one, that's a little one, you know. there's not hundreds of people running around saying little bigs. It's all done by photographing instantly those different fruits and sizing them and weighing them.
Well, it's all sorts. You know, there's all the analysis as well of how much water and sun and heat and all of that that goes into it, as well as margins and skews, and there's a lot that goes into it. It's a business.
I think that's part of the problem is that we're a very urbanised society. We, for a lot of people, the first sign they have of food is just to go down the aisle of a supermarket where the food is probably wrapped in plastic anyway, sadly.
Yeah.
But where does milk come from? Cows don't lay bottles.
No, they don't.
So, you know.
Same with eggs. If I give eggs to people, I say, can you please bring back the carton? And they look at you silly and we're like, well, the chickens don't lay the cartons. No. Oh, yeah, I suppose they don't.
Yeah, I mean, I've had it. Yeah, so that there is that real disconnect, I think, which it's particularly so in New Zealand and less in other countries. I know, for example, in St. Ireland, where I've got some very strong connections, there are still a generation of young people coming on who are still quite connected to the land because there are many small farms there, and people will have a uncle or an aunt or a whatever, a brother or sister who's on a farm of some sort, or have connections to it or go back to it at the weekend or whatever it might be. But we're not the same. So, it's interesting that that's what we're in that position at the moment.
Yeah,
so,
that needs to change.
And how do you change it? I don't know.
I don't know. The kids.
I get a bit sick of, you know, they're going to write another report about this. Oh, God, the bureaucrat's going to sit down in Wellington. He's never been out of Johnsonville in their lives. Write a report about this thing, and it's going to be, you know, I've used the word once, I better not use it again, but you know what I mean? It's related to the dairy industry.
Yeah, okay.
If you know what I mean. But that's the problem, that I think the only way to do it is, if I had my way, I'd be getting a fleet of buses out there and taking careers advisors and some parents out every month to universities to see researchers, to see horticultural blocks, to see dairy farms. The difficulty is, of course, if you're in Wellington and you say, well, let's go for a trip, it's 2 hours to Palmy, and you're not seeing anything much there. You've got to really, to see horticulture, you've got to go to probably to Hawke's Bay, or you can see commercial growing in Kapiti, obviously, but you can't see fruit growing like apples.
Yeah, it used to be, you know, a trip up maybe to Levin.
Yeah, but it isn't any longer. So, I mean, you've got the biggest apple growing area is Hawke's Bay. Mm. The biggest kiwi fruit area is Bay of Plenty. Commercial growing, we're very strong in. You know, Levin is really strong for that. And dairying, well, Manawatu is not the biggest. Waikato is. So it's you know, the lower North Island doesn't really give you that balance at all. And if you went to the Wairarapa to do wine, you'd only do a bit of sheep farming. We've tried that before. It's hard to get a day trip to show you all these things. Mm. And I accept people can't have the time to do it. But anyway.
Well, let's talk about a celebration then.
Yeah, celebration. We talked about one of the things that I went to was recently was the celebration of the top graduates at Massey. And that was a great night out for me to see. You've got to look and say, well, you know, this country's in the best of hands. These were young people coming through the courses at Massey, and really excellent, brilliant, fine, exciting, enthusiastic young people. And a couple of them from the cities. It was interesting that one of them, who won the top prize there, she had been originally doing an electrical engineering degree at Auckland University, and then for a holiday job, decided to work on a dairy farm, liked it, and changed the degree and went to Massey and did her degree in agriculture and has then become the top student. She's now, in her time, she's on a cattle station down in Tasmania. She flew over from Tasmania especially to get her award.
Oh, how fabulous.
A brilliant young individual. She's a wonderful. Interesting, most of the top students, well, a female as well. Interesting. They're bright and they're... You have to look and say, God, aren't we lucky we've got a generation of young people coming through who are highly intelligent, bright, practical, great people with good skills, personal skills, as well as academic skills.
Yeah.
And I just love going to this function. I've been to it now just about every year for 12 years, and I never get tired of going there to hear the great stories of these people. There was one there, she's won it before, she was the guest speaker, Abby Scott. She won it many years ago. She's now moved through the ranks, worked for Dairy NZ, and is now working for Rabobank as a consultant, as an agriculture consultant. Again, her degree at Massey has taken it on a path which has ended up, and she will probably go further than that. So I think that's what I love to go and see. It's nice to see people doing well and showing, we hear a lot of negative things about young people, but go along to this event and you'll really be, you'll come away thinking, my God, aren't we lucky we've got these wonderful young individuals who are so motivated, so intelligent, and going to do wonderful things for the country.
Well, that makes me feel good.
I like it.
We need the feel-good stories.
It is a good, and I've got another really good feel-good story too, which is around kiwi fruit. One of the highlights of my wanderings as I, you know, venture up and down the island at different times.
You sound like a womble.
I do. I'm a bit of a womble. I sort of, you know, load the cart with too many clothes and too many cameras and too many bits of gear or too many bags and head up the country. But I went up to Tauranga actually, and that's of course the Bay of Plenty, where it's the kiwi fruit part of the country. Waitapuki is the kiwi fruit capital of the country, as we know, very famous for that. And there was a celebration there of the New Zealand Kiwi Fruit Growers Incorporated. Now, they're the body that represents kiwi fruit growers. They're not the Zespri, which sells it. So you have they're an industry group. They look after the growers' interests. They represent them in terms of to the government for trade things. They keep a watchdog view on Zespri to make sure that the Zespri is doing the right thing by growers. It was 30 years since this group would be formed, and they had a big celebration there, and we got a panel of three people who'd played a big part in that, talking about the road to this. And the kiwi fruit industry we talk about now as being, you know, a very good industry, but it's gone through some pretty challenging times over the years. It's had ups and downs, and it started off, well, the first kiwi fruit came to New Zealand. They were actually brought out by a Whanganui school teacher at the turn of the last century.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that was the first kiwi fruit that ever came to New Zealand. A school teacher by the name of Isabel Fraser in 1904.
Wow.
That was the first seeds.
Isabel.
Isabel Fraser, 1904, kiwi fruit seeds from China.
Fantastic.
Chinese gooseberry.
Yes, the Chinese gooseberry, yep.
Yeah. So okay. Then... And then it sort of went in there, and the first we then started to grow these things, and the first exports of Chinese gooseberries were in 52. And then in 59, someone said, we can't call it Chinese gooseberries, it's ours. So they decided to call it kiwi fruit. And I think it was called kiwi fruit because it looked a bit like the kiwi. It had a fuzzy sort of brown look about it, and that's why I guess that's the reason they called it kiwi fruit, because it looked vaguely like a kiwi.
I don't think we were referred to as kiwis back in the 50s.
No, it's something we sort of came on. Yeah, we were still rather British. We sort of had the Union Jack and the Empire hanging over us, but we shrugged that off and we called ourselves kiwi fruit. Probably that was the first flag of independence, if you like, which is quite beautiful.
Cool.
But now, of course, it's a massive industry. It's worth about $4 billion kiwi fruit alone, and the horticulture sector, as we know, is really climbing every year exponentially, with apples and pears, among others, but, you know, nearly close to $8 billion a year now. It's a very big sector. So there was a lot of reason to celebrate. The other interesting person there was Don Brash. Now, many of you heard of Don Brash because of his other things today, of Hobson's Pledge, but he was the governor of the Reserve Bank. But I remember him back in 1982 when he was the chief executive or executive director of the Kiwi Fruit Marketing Board. I got scored some money out of him for a conference I was organising, and I've got a photograph of him, and I went up and saw him. And there was Don Brash, you know, 40 years on, so some very famous people have gone through this industry. And some of the people that were there were really interesting to talk to, because they had stories about what they did. There was a guy, Hendrix Peters, and he was one of those that came through, one of the original growers, came into it as a youngster when it was in its infancy, and did a lot to get together that group, because it was a pretty disparate. There was exporters in all directions. They were doing what New Zealand does best at in those days, was to every exporter undercut the other exporter, so therefore the grower got nothing literally for their kiwi fruit. And it was this sort of behaviour that ended up bringing the industry together and saying, look, there's a better way of doing this. And in the end, they got things together. They got a single desk seller, as we call it, which means that Zespri or its predecessor sold all the fruit. And then they formed this group, the industry group, the NZKGI, to be the advocate for it. And that was what it was all about. And I just sat there and was mesmerised by the night. There was just wonderful people who've done all sorts of great things. And just to think of where it's came from. And someone said, you know, we think about it's great, but remember where it came from. Remember the people that did the hard work 30 years ago. Remember those people that did it when we had PSA around, you know, all the work that went into that. And also remember recently, people did a great work around dealing with Cyclone Gabriel and with the frost that we had a few years ago. So, yeah, it's nice to go to functions where we can say we're proud to be New Zealanders. We're proud of the people, that the leadership that's been shown by people who most of us don't know about. I never knew about these people until I went there. But just to say how great they were, what a great job they've done, and to be able to thank them for that, it was great to do
that. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
And an amazing product that it is now as well.
It's a wonderful. And the thing about kiwifruit is that it's also, it's not just a lovely, tasty thing. It's also nutritious. We know it's got health properties. It's been, green kiwifruit, I know, for example, is always seen as being a product which is good for your health.
Mm.
Does all sorts of things to you. I've had some things that need to be done to me, and kiwifruit was one of those things I was told to eat to make me better.
Well, I think one of the things now it's touting to be is like an anti-cancer fruit as well. So it's just getting better, and I can tell you this season I'm addicted to the gold ones.
Gold is beautiful.
Oh, just divine.
I love gold too. It's beautiful. Really.
But they're all lovely, but I'm just addicted to
those. The red is very beautiful too.
Yeah, I haven't been able to get hold of the red so much. But,
you know, there's a limited. Red is designed specifically for the Asian market. You won't see red from New Zealand in Europe because its shelf life is shorter.
Okay.
That's one of its weaknesses. You know, that is really important that we do have that. And I think that kiwifruit is becoming incredibly popular around the world. It's doing well. It's surviving some of the challenges of the Chinese market, which, of course, is difficult at the moment. But people still want a good quality product there. So, as I've been saying, I've been wandering around the country, but one of the best places I went to was to a pāmu farm or a land court farm up in near Taupo. And it's interesting because it's a farm that backs onto the Waikato River, but they've converted it to organics. And that's not unusual because if you're in well near a river, you want to keep the nitrogen leaching down. But the interesting thing is the entire staff are Māori. And it's interesting to hear how Māori values and organic farming almost collide. It's a perfect match. And to go and see what is being done by this all Māori staff and working in organics, it's a very neat fit. And I was quite impressed to see this because a lot of most of Land Corps or Palmu's organic farms are down in this region around Foxton. But this is the only one up in the north. And the guy that's done it has come. He was trained as a lawyer, didn't quite fit his degree, said he had to get a job, started off in the dairy industry, and has moved now to be manager of this. And his wife is the same. And they're a beautiful couple. And just the way they do it, the whole thing is done in the Māori way, but within the organic parameter, so it's not, there is no leniency around that. You've got to meet the prescriptions, the directions, the rules around organic. But there is flexibility as to how you do it, and they do it their own way. They have their meetings at Karakia, all that sort of thing. And I think it was to me a privilege to go and talk to these people. They're very modest, that lovely line that Māori have, you know, the kuma does not boast about how sweet it is. And that was them. They didn't really want to talk up things. But for example, they said to me, you know, 4 years ago we didn't have worms on this farm. Now, because the way we're farming, we've planted different species of grasses. Now you can go to any paddock and put a spade down, you'll find worms. And that's a great thing.
That's awesome.
And I think that's something that's really, that we should celebrate and look at how Māori values and farming are very compatible, and it doesn't take away from the profitability. It just means that there is the way we used to do it, like, you know, Granddad did.
Yeah, always so, comes back to doing it properly.
It does come back, and doing it, and I think the fact that they have Māori values, which means you not only you treat you know, everything has got Māori to it. So in other words, it's got its own life. You treat your people well, you treat your soil well, healthy soil, healthy animals, good people, etc., etc., etc. So that's a positive note to end on. And I feel very privileged to be in the job I'm in because I get around and see some of these wonderful things, and I never bored.
How could you be? What a great update. Thank you so much, Peter.
This program was made with assistance from New Zealand On Air for radio broadcast and through the accessmedia.org.nz website. Thank you, New Zealand On Air.